Now, of course, there are very many metaphors for argumentation. A central component of the way that we talk and think of argumentation, we use different metaphors to try to describe, explain, and teach the practice. Now, a lot of the focus in argumentation theory is upon a certain specific set of metaphors, martial or military metaphors. So argumentation is war, is combat, we defend positions against attacks, we have strategies, we win or we lose, we can defeat people. And it's a consistent claim in particularly argumentation theory and feminist work on argumentation that these military metaphors have a particular negative or insidious effect upon the ways that we go about argumentation. So if you think back to Lakatoff and Johnson's classic 1984 book, The Metaphors We Live By, it starts with a description of the argument as war metaphor, and it singles this metaphor out as having particularly negative effects, and this has been carried on by the argumentation of the feminist theorists. So in an excellent paper by Phyllis Rooney on the concept of embattled reason, Phyllis says, the move to negative adversariality is rendered easy and perhaps inevitable by the embeddedness of the argument as war metaphor, in both how we conceptualise and how we practice arguments. So for Phyllis, one of the main causes of these negative, aggressive, stampy, fighty, argumentative behaviours is the entrenchment of this metaphor. Either, she says, the use of this metaphor makes it easier to act in these aggressive ways, or it might even make it inevitable. And so what we have to do, proposes Phyllis, is to prise loose this metaphor, to weaken its grip upon us. Or looking at argumentation theory, we've already heard about Daniel Cohen. So Cohen, in this 1995 paper, I think it's called Argument is War and War is Hell, Daniel says, the argument as war metaphor creates or emphasizes the adversarial aspect of argumentation. It is, he says, a dangerous metaphor, particularly when it is allowed to deform argumentation. So for Dan as well, it's the entrenchment of the argument as war metaphor, or the related set of these military metaphors, which tends to create or encourage or accelerate this negative argumentative behaviour. And as far as I can tell, this seems to be a general consistent theme amongst those who write on military metaphors. These metaphors are singled out as one of the primary causes of these negative aggressive behaviours. Of course, there's notes in either of a whole range of other factors as well, gendered interpersonal relations, power inequalities, the general moral and epistemic shittiness of human beings. But these metaphors are singled out having an important causal role. The metaphors by which we conceptualise the practice of argumentation have a central role in encouraging these negative behaviours. So the critical finger is pointed at the military metaphors. I want to suggest that's not quite right. I want to say it's not the metaphors themselves that are actually the cause of these behaviours, even the martial metaphors. I want to suggest that the critics are right, that there is an important dimension in which the ways that we metaphorise arguments can encourage these negative, aggressive, forceful behaviours, but it's not the metaphors themselves. It's the ways that the metaphors are received, unpacked, and deployed in our argumentation. So it's not the metaphors, it's the way that we use and interpret the metaphors. In which case, the critical target is not the metaphors, but the cultures and the practices to which we select, appraise, deploy, and use these metaphors. I want to suggest that even the military metaphors can be rescued, and that it would be possible to use military metaphors to promote argumentative virtues rather than just argumentative vices. In which case, the focus should be the cultures and practices in which we use the metaphors, not the metaphors themselves. Now, that's not to deny that certain metaphors can be, as it were, more or less likely to encourage negative behaviours. So I think there might be a greater risk that aggressive, militaristic, violent metaphors, which have a greater tendency to encourage certain types of vicious behaviour than gentler or softer metaphors. So maybe if you do think about metaphor of argumentation in terms of war and combat, you're sort of leaning towards aggressive behaviour more than you would if you're using metaphors of argumentation as a dance, or as friendship, or courtship, perhaps. But still, none of these metaphors will be intrinsically corrupting. What will depend is the wider cultures in which we use them. So none of these metaphors will be intrinsically corrupting. It will depend much upon the culture. Okay. Now, what I suggest then is that no metaphor in itself will necessarily point to a specific set of virtues or vices. Now, what I mean by vices here is something like epistemic vices in the sense that Kassim Kassam has defined them. So for Kassim, an epistemic vice is a character trait, an attitude, or a way of thinking that will tend in different ways to obstruct inquiry. In this case, to obstruct argumentative practice. So think back to Alessandra's talk yesterday, we had a good introduction to this. So the vice of dogmatism, for example, obstructs inquiry because the dogmatic person cannot respond in appropriate ways to epistemic options. They will be averse to certain epistemic options and won't engage with them for dodgy reasons. Now that person is going to obstruct inquiry. The central feature of inquiry, you have to respond to certain epistemic options in the right the aggressive person, for example, that person will tend to obstruct inquiry. Because if a person's going to be very, very aggressive, other people aren't going to want to tentatively offer ideas they're not quite sure about, but which might actually be really good ideas. If they know that they're going to receive a negative, aggressive response, that person is obstructing inquiry. They are blocking inquiry. That's the way I'm using the term epistemic virtues. And here, I'm just going to focus upon argumentative epistemic virtues and vices. I don't quite know how to distinguish epistemic and argumentative virtues and vices. I'm just going to suggest that there's a general set of epistemic virtues and vices. They can manifest in specific epistemic practices, like argumentation. Now, it's interesting, if you look at the history of reflection on argumentative practice, commentators have consistently used a vocabulary of vices. So this is the connection between the metaphors and the vices and the practices. So, for example, Phyllis talks about certain people who argue as being aggressive, combative, hostile. These can be features of cultures or climates, but also, of course, features of persons. Daniel Pellin talks about argumentative arguers, he says. They are proficient, pedantic, petty, forceful, domineering. If you jump right back in history, Aristotle, for example, talks about certain people who are, he says, cantankerous, competitive, ready to pounce. These people, he says, impede the common work of philosophy. If you look at ancient Buddhist manuals and argumentation, you find similar descriptions of types of people who are apt to spoil discussion, aggressive, forceful, cantankerous, disputatious. I dare say you can consult your professional histories and memories and identify people like this. Now, what's interesting is that there is this consistent vocabulary of vices that we use to think normatively about what argumentation ought to be and what arguers, or good arguers, ought to be as well. And of course, this is consistent with a very popular set of images about argumentation. So think about a classic institution of argumentation in the UK, the House of Parliament. If you watch BBC Parliament, it's very depressing. It's jeering and shouting, braying and point scoring, and people thumping tables and laughing at inappropriate moments. So there's this kind of idea that argumentation can typically be vicious. And so there's this intuitive sense that somehow those aggressive military metaphors focused upon aggression, violence, point scoring, and forcefulness and domination are going to be connected to these vices somehow. What would be the connection between the metaphors and the vices? Intuitively, there is a connection there. But there'd be a lot of philosophical work to do to explain how those metaphors would actually encourage those vices. I mean, for one thing, there are many, many different causes of bad argumentative behaviour. It's not just going to be the metaphors. And of course, there are many different metaphors. Argument as war, argument as a game, argument as a dance, argument as social exchange. In which case, why would it be those metaphors? Why the military metaphors that would force these behaviours? What is the connection between the entrenchment of certain metaphors and the promotion of certain vices? How do you make that connection? Well, what I want to propose is that certain types of metaphors, specifically those that Lovecraft and Johnson called structural metaphors, so these are metaphors that model one set of activities on another. They model the structure of one activity, like argumentation, on another activity, like war. Now, I want to say that these structural metaphors can enable an implicit transfer of normative character traits from one domain to the other. So if you're modelling and conceptualising argumentation on something like war or combat or forcefulness, you're creating a structural connection between those two activities. Once you have that structural connection, you can start to transfer character traits, dispositions, conceptions from one to the other. But typically the transfer won't be automatic or principled or reflective. The connection is there. And once the connection is there between them, these things will flow between them. So you can have transfer in something like a structured, organized sense, Kathleen things, but you can also have just an accidental, fluid transfer between them. And what I want to suggest is that when someone's operating with a structural metaphor, argument is war, that what they're going to do, implicitly and without wanting to, is to implicitly transfer normative character traits. Because once you have argument is war, in a sense you can ask the question, what are the qualities of a good combatant, or a good warrior or soldier? And then you'll also be asking a parallel question. What are the qualities of a good arguer? What sorts of qualities, dispositions do you need? And what will often happen, I think, is that people implicitly transfer those normative character traits. So what's a good soldier, at least in the popular imagination? Forceful, aggressive, kill or be killed, determined to beat their enemy, to defeat them, to destroy them, to leave no one left standing, to be victorious and champion, and so on. In that case, you might start to implicitly transfer those normative character traits structurally into the other domain. What is the good arguer? Forceful, aggressive, domineering. They want to win. They want to beat their opponents. They want to leave no one left.
They want to be that irritating point-scoring person who chalks up their kills and their wins and their victories. And you have implicit transfer of normative character traits. And I think that's typically what tends to happen. So if you look at the ways in which people describe argumentation, for instance, in philosophy, they're implicitly employing a martial vocabulary, a set of martial conceptions of what a person ought to be. So Dan Cohen says, sorry, this is Blackhoff and Johnson, we can actually win or lose arguments. We see the person we're arguing with as an opponent. We attack his positions. We defend our own. We gain and lose ground. We do plan and use strategies. Many of the things that we do in arguing are partially structured by the concept of war. So if you're using the argument as war metaphor, you create a structural connection between those two domains. And what can happen if you're not very careful is that implicit normative character traits get transferred from the one domain into the other. And your implicit conception of what a good combatant is starting to illicitly function as your implicit normative conception of what a good arguer will be. Especially, of course, if you're working within an academic culture where the people held up as exemplars of a good arguer tend to be aggressive, forceful, domineering, combative, the one with a killer objection, the one who, when you raise your hand, you go pale because they're going to destroy your paper. Often these people are held up wrongly as exemplars, in which case you have a structural metaphor interacting with a culture. You have an implicit transfer of normative character traits from the martial to the argumentative domain, reinforced by a culture where aggressive, forceful, martial people tend to be celebrated. So if you think, for example, what would be the qualities of a good soldier, a good warrior? Well, they might be a person disposed to take an aggressive satisfaction in victory and in beating people. They have an affective disposition. They like winning. They like being the one who won. They have a determination to defeat their opponent, to beat them. Or they might be someone who has that particular type of cleverness that manifests in finding and exploiting weaknesses in the other person's position. Whether it's, you know, the weakness in the armour, or the gap in their formation where you could push your cavalry, or that little presupposition they made in section 2 where if you put a little bit of critical pressure, the whole thing will collapse. In which case, you can see how this would function. Normative character traits getting transferred from the one domain to the other via the metaphor. Now, I think that's right as far as it goes, but I think that's actually much too quick. It's much too unfair on a martial metaphor. And the reason is that I think that actually the martial metaphor can specify a whole range of other character traits. What we have here is a myopic view of the argument as war metaphor. There is much more in that argument as war metaphor that we can draw upon. So you can think about argumentation and war, for example, not just in terms of these aggressive, fighty character traits. If you actually take a closer look, for example, at the domain of martial practice, you get a very different view. So I asked a few soldiers about this, and they said, well, this sounds strange, because aggressiveness is not a martial virtue. If you look, for example, at military codes, like the Bushido Code, aggressiveness is not a virtue. The soldier I spoke to said, no, you don't want the aggressive person in your regiment. Aggressiveness is the first thing that gets trained out of you, because the aggressive person is the one who wants to get the guns quickly and run into battle. That person's not safe to themselves, they're not safe to their unit. So actually, many of these martial virtues are not martial virtues at all. Discipline, restraint, cautiousness, careful, esprit de corps, loyalty, commitment to a higher purpose. If you actually look at it, they are actually the martial virtues. And if you start to think about it in that way, there's much more buried within the martial metaphors that we could be drawing upon. In which case, the argument of the war metaphor has what Ronald Hepburn calls intentional density. It's dense or thick or rich with different associations between the two domains. So there are lots of things that are in common between war and argumentation. Some of these involve combat, fighting, antagonism, adversarialism, and so on. But there are many, many other associations of a happier, more virtuous quality. For example, argumentation and combat both involve discipline and restraint and training and practice and dedication to an ideal and working together as a group and coordination of a range of people in pursuit of a common ideal. It involves discipline and self-transformation and so on. In which case, there's much, much more buried within the metaphor of argument as war that we could be drawing upon. And the happy thing here is that once we take this richer view of the domain of combat, we see that we could carry on many more traits over into the domain of philosophy. The problem is, though, of course, that not all of these associations are recognised. People go straight for fighting and combat and war and victory and killing. They don't go for discipline and restraint and esprit de corps. So not all of the associations are recognised.
And even when associations are recognised, they're not always properly judged as appropriate. So people recognise, for example, the shared association of competition between two or more persons, but they think that's a good thing to be encouraged. And they go for competition rather than, for example, cooperation. So what we need then is some way to determine what sorts of traits should be carried over. So the question is, if you like, what sorts of qualities are martial virtues, but which, if transferred over into the domain of argumentation, would manifest as argumentative virtues? Because some traits, when they're carried over, will manifest as vices. So that's one way in which transfer goes wrong. You transfer the wrong traits. So maybe some form of aggressiveness is a martial virtue, but it's only going to be a virtue in the martial domain. And if you carry it over into the argumentative domain, it becomes a vice. Some things become vicious in the transfer. So there's one way it can go wrong. You carry over the wrong traits. Another way this can go wrong, you fail to carry over relevant traits. So courage and self-restraint are martial virtues. So the soldier I spoke to said, the most important thing, he said, if you're a sniper, is knowing when not to pull a trigger. He says, self-restraint is the sniper's first virtue. Now, in that case, self-restraint is going to be a martial virtue. But self-restraint is also a philosophical virtue. But if that trait is not transferred, you have another way it goes wrong. So you transfer the wrong traits and they become vicious in the transfer, or you don't transfer the traits you should, and self-restraint lies trapped on the one side. So there's two ways these transfers can go wrong. You transfer the wrong traits, they become vicious in the transfer, or you fail to transfer the correct traits, the virtues. Now, if that's the case, we could think much more richly about the relationship between the argument as war metaphor and argumentative practice. We can ask, well, what sorts of traits should we transfer? So maybe there's a common feature of argumentative and military practice, something like a disposition to persist with an activity despite the active threat of some sort of harm to yourself. You know, maybe holding a position literally under fire, or defending a position in front of a room full of hostile philosophers who are firing criticisms. I take it there is a common virtue there, the virtue of courage. Now, courage, we heard this from Andrew yesterday, that will manifest in both domains as a virtue. Because although the types of threat and harm are very different, you know, mortar shells falling or criticisms coming in, still, you need that disposition to be able to persist with an activity like arguing while you're subject to threats and harms. In that case, a transfer is legitimate. But you can think of other traits that do function as virtues in the martial domain that don't carry over. So maybe something like a disposition to interact with somebody where the aim is to leave them in a state of permanent incapacity, to defeat them, maybe to kill them, to break them, to crush them. That might sometimes be a virtue in the martial domain, because it is sometimes necessary in military practice for you to try to leave your opponents in permanent incapacity, to defeat them, to destroy them, to kill them, to stop them advancing. Something like that might be a virtue in the martial domain. But that's not going to be a virtue at all when it's transferred over into the argumentative domain. Because if your aim is to crush or defeat your opponent such that they will never, ever, ever debate with anybody ever again, that's not an advantage. So Simone de Beauvoir, for example, has this very famous account where she describes the effect on her of a conversation she had with Sartre about some moral idea she was developing. And she says, Sartre's objections, he says, were so intensive, so extensive, and so vociferous that at the end of this, she says, not only did I not know what I thought anymore about the issue, I didn't even know that I thought anymore. He said, he'd done such immense damage to my intellectual self-confidence, says, I thought I would never think again. That's not a virtue, that's a vice. That's something like malevolence or aggressiveness. Because it's one thing we need in argumentation, which Campion emphasises, is that we need other people to do it as well. So it might be appropriate in a military domain to try to leave the people you're interacting with in a state of permanent incapacity, because they're the enemy. But that's not going to be a virtue when it's transferred over into the philosophical domain. Congratulations, you've crushed the anti-realist. Well, that's not to my advantage, because we need them for critical pushback. So the question is then, what sorts of traits should we transfer? In particular, what would be our criterion? Now, this is the question. Well, assuming everything I've just said is fairly persuasive, then, well, why don't people tend to see the richness of the association with metaphor? I mean, I've only done it in 10 minutes, but we could carry this exercise on, and we can actually have a much happier view of the argument as war metaphor. So the question is, this is the question that Phyllis really pushes in her paper, well, why then do we have such a negative, jaundiced view of the argument as war metaphor? Why does that metaphor have such a bad rep? Now, the answer that she and Daniel Cohen and many others give is that the metaphor itself is at fault. I think that's wrong. As I've tried to show, the metaphor itself is actually intentionally dense. It has many rich associations. You can get an awful lot of good stuff out of the martial metaphors. It's not, if you like, the enemy. The question is then, well, why do we tend to regard the metaphor so negatively? And this is where I think the critics get the target wrong. It's not the metaphor, it's the cultures within which we receive, select, process, deploy, and explore these different metaphors. Now, I think Rooney is exactly right when she identifies one of the main culprits here. When she asks, why is the argument as war metaphor so entrenched in contemporary philosophical practice? She says, very persuasively, the reason is that academic philosophy, as it's developed, has come to contingently inherit certain gendered conceptions of confidence, epistemic performance, masculinity, which associates them strongly with aggression, forcefulness, violence, and domination. So she's playing on the work of feminist historians like Genevieve Lloyd, for example, most obviously, and says part of the reason this metaphor has become entrenched is because we have come, for contingent historical reasons, to associate masculinity and epistemic performance with confidence, violence, domination, forcefulness, and so on. And it's forced out alternative conceptions. Now, Phyllis, as I read her, she thinks the metaphor itself does this, where I think it doesn't, because we can squeeze much more else out of that metaphor. The problem, the target of the criticism here, should be the culture then, because what that culture is doing is distorting our practices of metaphorizing, and it distorts them in different ways. For example, it prevents us from seeing certain of the associations, so it has a sort of an aspect bias. We're not seeing the more positive aspects of those military metaphors. So it distorts our practices of metaphorizing, partly by forcing upon us a myopic view. We look at the domain of kind of the martial domain, and we see war, fighting, and combat. We don't see discipline, restraint, devotion, loyalty, commitment to a higher cause. Those aspects of metaphor are occluded by that culture. Also, of course, the range of metaphors that tend to become entrenched, that will also be distorted. There's a whole range of metaphors, but we default to that martial one. Well, why not argumentation as dance or as conversation? These metaphors have been developed historically, but they get pushed out. So I think that culture can corrupt practices of metaphorizing in different ways. It can force out certain metaphors, or it can marginalize them, or the ones that it puts forward, it can give us very myopic views. And that's exactly what I think is happening with the martial metaphors. We're seeing only certain of those associations, certain of those connections between the two domains. That's one consequence of this martial culture. And the consequence of that is that we have the entrenchment of a very narrow interpretation of a single set of martial metaphors. And this means that we can't make those transfer decisions. We can't make the proper judgments about which traits transfer from the one domain into the other. If so, that would mean that those cultures of metaphorizing are corrupting, in the technical sense that they promote the development and the exercise of vices. Because it prevents us from asking questions like, what range of metaphoric resources do we need to accurately map the domain of normative argumentative inquiry? Because what we have is only one set of metaphors and only one set of aspects, and we don't have the sufficiently rich metaphoric resources we need to identify those normative traits. In which case, it's not the metaphors at all, it's the ways that those metaphors are allowed to be explored, developed, deployed, and implemented in our argumentative practices. In which case, let's not abandon the military metaphors, as some argue. Let's keep them, because there's good stuff in them. We should pluralize those metaphors by having many more of them, but also pluralize internally. We need to see the full range of the associations between them, because there are many legitimate structural parallels between arguing and warfare, and we need to keep those on the table. So don't criticize the metaphors, criticize the cultures within which those metaphors are explored and developed, which requires, among other things, much more sensitivity to normative metaphilosophy, which should be more of a philosophy, and much closer contact with feminist literature and argumentation. But this still leaves one question outstanding, actually, which is the question, well, what actually would be our criterion, then, for deciding which traits get transferred over? I mean, so far I've been talking very easily about virtues and vices, but a big question is, well, how do you decide which traits are virtues and vices? When we're making these transfer decisions, so when you have these two metaphors structurally connected, argument as war, you can think about the procedure. Okay, we have a martial trait, aggressiveness, or whatever it is. Do we transfer this over into the domain of argumentation? We need some criteria to decide whether to approve that transfer. So how can you tell if a martial trait would manifest as an argumentative virtue? How can you license that transfer? Well, here, I'm just going to lean on Katharina's account. We already have the obvious criterion for whether a trait ought to be transferred. The normative criterion is the social nature of argumentation. Because when you ask the question that Katharina gave to us, What sorts of traits, virtues, dispositions do we need in order to facilitate effective argumentative practice, where argumentative practice is a social activity involving a plurality of agents with different abilities, dispositions, levels of confidence, forms of self-esteem, at different stages in their epistemic development? Given all of that, what sorts of traits do we need to argue effectively? That's your normative criterion. Okay, we have martial trait one. Should this be transferred? Would it manifest as a virtue that would encourage social argumentative practice? In the case of malevolence, forcefulness, relentlessness, those traits I don't think would. So the relentless person who will never give up, that might be a virtue in combat. They won't surrender, they're not going to retreat too soon. That might be a virtue in the martial context. Relentlessness, giving, kind of refusing to give up, even in the face of heavy fire or opposition or forcefulness, that might be a martial virtue. But transferred over into an argumentative domain, that very well might not be a virtue, because one crucial thing in argumentation is to know when to stop. For example, when to recognise that you're now at the point of intensity in the exchange, where you can see that person's self-esteem and confidence starting to fracture. You can see it breaking in front of you. It's the trembling in the voice, it's the nervousness, it's the shaking of the hands. That's when you need to stop. Because at that point, your argumentative practice is starting to have negative effects upon them. Relentlessness then is not a virtue. Because if you're relentless, you'll see excellent. They're starting to fracture, they're starting to go, and you push through. You see this at many philosophy conferences. In that case, no, we refuse to transfer. Relentlessness, that is not going to manifest in the argumentative domain as a virtue. Transfer refused. So it's a martial virtue, fine. But when it comes to something like self-restraint, now that is, as I said, a virtue of soldiers. But then you ask the transfer question. If we transfer the trait of self-restraint over into the argumentative domain, would this manifest as a virtue? Well, yes. Because one of the things that you need in argumentative practice is a degree of self-restraint. Restraining the urge, for example, to push in with another objection, with another criticism, holding back the things you want to say to see if your interlocutor can come round to them themselves. Restraining your knowledge, experience, abilities, and insights, especially, of course, if you are epistemically more advanced than them. For example, if you're having a debate between people of different ranks or levels. This is a crucial virtue of self-restraint. So in that case, transfer approved. Self-restraint can be transferred over into the argumentative domain because it would manifest as a virtue for the reason it would facilitate argumentation as a social practice. Now, if all this is right, then it's not going to be the metaphors that are the problem here, because these metaphors can do good or bad work. They're not intrinsically corrupting. Even the martial ones are not intrinsically corrupting. They become corrupting when they are deployed and embedded within certain types of culture. In this case, highly aggressive, high-performative, masculinist cultures that encourage traits like forcefulness, aggressiveness, competitiveness, and so on. But absent those cultures, if we lived in a happier culture, those metaphors could do very, very good work. We would have a very different perspective on those metaphors. In which case, the problem is not the metaphors, but the cultures within which our practice of metaphorizing proceed. So what you would need then is not the abandonment of the metaphors, or just the pluralization of metaphors. You need a transformation of those cultures, so that we can properly perceive the whole range of rich associations of the metaphoric resources available to us, to explore them and ensure that certain of their associations are not being occluded or downplayed or marginalised. And I think it will be a general truth that many of our cultures, unfortunately, for sort of sociological reasons Katharina described, like grant chasing, competing for slots at conferences, this encourages a competitive, aggressive, zero-sum mode of academic conduct, in which case our culture itself is corrupting. It has structural incentives for vicious conduct. Jumping in, being the first one, pushing yourself to the front of the queue, pushing other people out of the way. The culture itself is corrupting. But it's not going to be the metaphors themselves that accelerate this. It'll be the culture itself.